outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Kyle, I made it through the third anniversary of my 69th birthday.
The third anniversary of your 69th birthday. I deeply appreciate that. I'm very glad that you made it through that, by the way.
Me too. I've got friends who tell you no one wants to listen to anything you say once you're 70. So I'm just going to keep holding at 69.
See, and I thought you were 59. So now here I am a complete decade off.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Maybe I should have started that way. The 13th anniversary of my 59th birthday.
Exactly.
No, I didn't. It was a tough week too. My goodness, it was pretty dark.
Yeah, how
not so? My birthday part, but I just, man, one of those weeks where everything just piled on top of me. And I don't mean worky kind of stuff. I mean, just back pain was horrible. I've got something going on with my back that seems to be more than the surgery. It's had some conversations that just made the whole cancer thing seem darker than I was appreciating. And it just, I don't know, man. It just took me under. It really just put me for a couple of days. I mean, I couldn't sleep at night. I just
really,
yeah, I was really funked out. Talked to some people to help me try to find a way back. And I think most of it was just the back pain that was just getting worse enough to think there's something else wrong with my back than just what the surgery accomplished. But all that began to break on Thursday. Somehow God's light shone through all that. Got my eyes out of the weeds, back onto him. That this is not about me. It's not about how good I can be. It's not about how much I can fix anything. It's just about trusting him for the unfolding of my life. And so through a dark space, back to that wonderful time celebrating my birthday with Sarah. Some friends came together over a pretty wide area for lunch on Saturday that was very encouraging. So somehow I found my way to lighter space. And it's helpful right now that Sarah is either finished her last memory or between them. And we never know what.
Yeah.
But the lightness of her voice and the lightness of her laughter, it's just, it's so sweet. That's been a big part, I think, of finding my way back home.
It doesn't happen to you very often. I think over the stint of our friendship, I haven't heard you comment about being in those dark days very often.
I don't tend to be very often. I mean, this was worse than when I was in the hospital and found out about all this stuff. Yeah. And I don't know why it seemed more than just the circumstances. It seemed like the enemy was having a hand, or
yeah,
those who write dark things, or screw tape was after me or something. But yeah, I have not been in that kind of a darker space for a while, but it's good to find a way to just lean into Jesus and let that wash away eventually. It took some time. It did. But man, I feel a lot better now, feel a lot lighter. The back pain has decreased significantly.
I was wondering, you said that there was some darker assignment to the back pain, the cancer. What did you mean by that?
Darker assignment? I don't think that's words I use.
There was a conversation that you had that it put the cancer in a darker perspective than you had initially.
Yeah, it was more than one conversation. It was a couple of them.
Okay.
And it just came from a real negative slant. And so you get your mind focused on the human side of it instead of I'm not alone in it. God's with me.
Yeah.
And every day of my life is numbered in his hands. So medicine's all about here's how it works for most people. They don't ever know what actually it's going to transpire until it does. But I felt really invited back into a trust in God about it's never the mortality part of this thing. No, man, I can't wait to get to the other side of this. I was telling some friends I was with on Saturday. It's like, finally, we're going to be able to look back on our lives from that perspective of eternity and go, oh, that's what that was about. Like, we don't have any idea now, but someday we'll know. And I'm looking forward to that. So I'm not, it's not the mortality side of this thing. It's just simply just being overwhelmed by the journey to get there.
That's fair.
Through okay. what could happen through these things, but we don't know. All of it's in God's hands, like I said.
It seems like both you and Sarah are navigating that conversation in your own unique ways. Like you're navigating it through more of these physical illness stuff, ailments that you're facing, whether it be the back, the spinal stuff or the cancer. And for her, navigating it through more of a mental health world of the trauma and the reoccurring dreams and the things that are being untangled there for her. Do you see some parallels or crossovers in God's light coming into those spaces for the two of you, or is he doing that in different ways?
He's doing it in different ways, I think, because there are different demands. But what's constant is the way Sarah holds me up in the physical side of this thing and the way I get to hold her up in the emotional side of her trauma. Mm. And that's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful dance right now of when Sarah comes to the fore to care for what's going on with me, and then when I come to the fore to care of what's happening with her.
Yeah.
But like I said, we're kind of on a break with her, which is nice. Mm-hmm. Nice timing. There were a couple of times this weekend where her laughter just so free and so wonderful. And it just makes my heart sing.
I'm looking forward to getting to be able to hear that in person again soon. So
someday.
I'm excited for that. Yeah. I'll tell you more about that. I think we've got a trip planned out there for May.
We'll talk later, my friend.
Okay.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey.
Best thing you heard this week.
Best thing I heard this week came from Sarah.
Oh, okay.
No, we were on a walk and I'd been thinking the day before, working on some writing project I'm working on. And I somehow had a thought about this, Jesus saying, "Oh, ye of little faith." And the thought hit my mind, what if that was a lament rather than an accusation? Because I've always read it as, "Oh, ye of little faith."
Totally.
Why are you so afraid? And it's kind of like when Sarah pushed in on it a little bit, I said, like, kind of, it's demeaning. Mm. It was demeaning him a little bit. And what if it's a lament? Oh, that's right. You don't have this faith yet. Because on what basis would they have thought God would calm storms at their request? You know what I mean? They had no, if faith and trust is something Jesus wins us into, he's doing that with them. And part of it's in this conversation, I think. He's winning them into it. And so I just said, I've always seen that as kind of a demeaning shot at the disciples. And Sarah says, oh, I never have. I never take Jesus' words as demeaning. And I went, never? She goes, no. If I thought he would demean me, I wouldn't feel safe with him.
Ooh.
And I just, I think there are a few things I read where it seems like Jesus is being demeaning. And to get to the point of going, I never take his words that way. Thinking, this is Sarah's rules of hermeneutics point one, and I'm going to take it. Jesus, even I think when he's telling the Pharisees, scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, I know people point to that and say, oh, he's being demeaning. He could be doing that in an angry tirade. Mm-hmm. He could be doing it in an honest exploration of where their hearts are that wouldn't be demeaning in its presentation. So I even think that fits into this thing. But we it was just a great conversation. I never take his words that way. And I went, what? I didn't hear this in Bible class. She says, no, if he was demeaning, then I wouldn't be safe with him and I wouldn't be with him. Mm. I love that. How about you?
I was actually listening to a podcast. We were down at my family's place because we were on spring break this last week, and was listening to a podcast on the drive back, and they were talking about the sociology of where the masculine heart is right now. And this wasn't a Christian podcast. It was a secular social psychologist that was looking at this, and he said, we live in a world of floundering men desperate for hope. And that was an interesting, to me, it's not a best, but it definitely stopped me in my tracks to hear somebody that is studying from the secular world, mainstream world, put it in that level of context was really good, because for me, that's, I have such a heart for where men are at today, and especially younger guys, and them knowing what does it mean to thrive in the world. And yet, man, to have that, I felt like fairly raw statement of, we live in a world of floundering men desperate for hope. That was, That was interesting to me.
Wow. You think that's unique to younger men?
No. I don't.
Because I wonder when we live in, and I will agree that we live in a fairly male-dominated society. I definitely grew up in one, right?
Yeah.
And for men to whine about not having opportunity or confidence or whatever, to me, if you're a woman listening to that, you gotta think, dude, all of it is in your hands much more than ours. Mm. Now, I know that, you know, some of the entertainment, whatever, they kind of knock masculinity a lot and they make it, everything's toxic if you're like to fish or hunt or whatever. But it would be like white people complaining about racism when you've benefited from it for, and not in a good way, but you've made use of it. And so that's why I come to think, why do you think men are so in despair? How do you see that?
For me, I think, especially when I talk to a lot of younger guys, there's this sense of, a lot of guys across the age demographic, who are you? Can you give me a brief identity statement of who you are and just kind of what your purpose is in this world? Can you give me a brief snapshot of what that is? I would say maybe 15% have an answer.
Well, that's not true of my relationships, but
really?
Yeah. And I would also say, I think a lot of women would say the same thing.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. I was with a gal last week in her mid sixties. And she just retired and she said, I'm not going to my job. I don't even know what my purpose is on the planet. Mm. I'm going, that's kind of sad to me. Mm. 65, you don't have a sense of why God's put you on the planet and what now your retirement years can offer to you. And I don't blame her for that. She just hasn't had it. So I don't know. You say it's more unique to men than women that you know?
I think it's more... I guess for me, it's a lot of the men that I'm having that conversation with, and it's very disruptive to them. I'm not saying that it isn't to women, but even the college students that I ask them and say, okay, tell me in three sentences or less, who are you and what is your purpose in this world? I mean, and this could be a 50-year-old working professional that's coming back for additional education, or an 18-year-old that's just coming out of high school. And yet there's this pause of, I don't know. I don't even know where to start to begin to tell you that. And I think there's a lot, I think it's a very diverse and complex reason. I think there's a lot of layers to it. Why a lot of men that I talk to feel like they're floundering in the world.
And is that because of their masculinity or confusion about what masculinity is? Or is it just the reality of their individual person that they just never found that sense of purpose yet?
It could be a little bit of both, honestly. Okay. I think especially for guys in American society, there's a lot of, I don't think there's a lot of direction. I mean, you can go like Mark Driscoll or John Eldridge, or I mean, you can go some of the more like very definitive, this is what a man is and this is how you live in the world, you know, kind of a thing.
Go rescue the damsel from the castle. And
yes.
Be the hero.
Yes. And in some regards, I mean, I think both you and I would agree that when we're helping someone, when we're rescuing someone, when we're fighting for somebody and when we offer our strength to someone and it's a resource to them, that it feels good. But I don't know. I just, my heart continues to be drawn back to, Lord, how do we start creating additional spaces for specifically your sons? And I guess this is just the demographic that I'm connecting with on a regular basis, mm-hmm. but specifically your sons, so that they have this sense of self, the sense of worth in the world, because so many that I talk to, they don't. And then if they don't, there's this, often it's coupled with this fear of, but I don't want to be that. I am actively avoiding being X, Y, or Z. And a lot of it has to do with the the anger or the aggression or the cold and distant, or, you know, some of those type characteristics.
The macho kind of thing, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah. I don't know. And especially when we think about leadership or power in the world today, there's this struggle of, I don't want to be a pushover doormat. I don't want to be Rambo. And I don't know really where to look or how to learn what it means to live a life of purpose and meaning that isn't some caricature one way or the other.
Wow. Well, I hope they get to sort that out.
Yeah. I'm intrigued that your group, your community of people don't experience, like, that's not very prominent in your community of individuals.
Yeah, and I'm thinking across demographics as well. I'm thinking of the young men I know, the 30s, 40s men I know. They all seem to have, and I mean, nobody's worked out their purpose in a way they could write it out in three sentences or whatever. But if you talk to them about why they're on the planet, what excites them, what, I think most of them are pretty grounded in what they're a part of. There's going to be some that aren't. I'm not saying they all are, but I would just say it'd be the opposite of you. I'd be 85 to 15 instead of 15 to 85. Okay. But that gives you a mission field. So go for it, dude.
Now I just got to find a way to monetize it.
Perfect. Perfect, Kyle. That's exactly why we do this podcast. So you can find a way to monetize your... No, but a way to find time to spend with them, whether it's hiking up to Sow Belly Creek or whatever, or taking fly fishing or...
Absolutely.
Anyway, do you get a chance to look at this Drunk with Power I sent to you?
I did. It was a very interesting read.
Yeah, I found this. It's from the BBC Science Focus magazine. Ian Taylor is the author, Drunk with Power. Let me just read you the first little bit of it. It says, power does strange things to people. One famous paper by researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, reports the results of 7 experiments that observe the behavior of people with higher or lower power and social status. To summarize the findings, powerful people are the worst. Now, I love that because I've thought this is true for a long time. So to have actual documentation, you powerful people are the worst. And what he means by this is the team found that high power individuals are more likely to lie during negotiations and cheat to increase their chances of winning a game. They're more likely to endorse unethical behavior and even take sweets from a jar that they were told was meant for children in the lab next door. The lead author of the paper, Professor Docker Keltner, co-director of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. Now people can say, Berkeley, you can't listen to that. But he says there's no shortage of evidence that power is a corruptive force. And he talks about it across the line. It's not just, he says power exists everywhere. It permeates not just boardrooms and political offices, but every classroom, every workplace, every marriage, every congregation, which he doesn't say, but I'm going to say it. It crackles in virtually all human interactions and relationships, underpinning the social hierarchies that govern much of human behavior. So you as a social guy, social scientist guy, what do you think of this?
Well, I think he goes, there's an interesting, he goes on to say, they don't care about caring. They don't care about justice. They care about authority.
Yeah.
And it's so intriguing to me because our culture points towards or places a high value on gaining control and power, gaining influence. And yet the way that it impacts humanity, the way that it impacts your character and your heart and your vision of how you are in the world. I remember having a really long conversation with a good friend of mine that works with extremely high-end C-level executives, etc. And he and I were just chatting and he was kind of lamenting. He was like, I think I work with sociopaths. I think all I work with every single day is sociopaths. And we were talking about what does it take in order to get to that level of authority or power or influence, whether it be in government or church organization or commercial industry, what does it take to get there? And especially when we're thinking that line about they don't care about caring, they don't care about justice. That stood out to me so strongly as we've been talking about our conversation about justice versus righteousness. It's like they don't care about becoming a just person in the world.
No.
Because if they do, then will they be able to acquire the human power and authority, the man-made power, or as we were talking about last week, empire, right? Empire authority in this world.
Yeah. I think it's powerful about this article. It's not saying, hey, bad people acquire power.
Correct.
What the article is saying is the more power you gain, that the brain actually disrupts empathy, concern, compassion. So that the more power you gain, the more corrupt you become. That's the point. It's not corrupt people get power. It's the power corrupts.
Correct.
And I look at that from a theological standpoint. You go back to Saul and David and wherever. Here's God handpicking a couple of kings for him. And both of them, David turned out better than Saul, obviously, but both of them were somewhat corrupted by the power that they had. The more they gained control over other people, and the more they had the freedom to do whatever they wanted to do because they had the means to do it, the more twisted their hearts became. And that's the point of this. It's like power is like alcohol. It actually, or like trauma, it actually reshapes the brain so that you don't even consider things like justice. And he said at one point in the article, empathy is one of the ways you gain power, because you have empathy for other people and you're open and vulnerable and people are drawn to that. And then we choose leaders out of that. But then leaders lose that skill when they no longer need it to gain power. They've already got the power they want or wanted. And now it's a matter of exercising that power, like you said, in a way that doesn't reflect at all on what's just, what's fair, what's kind.
It's interesting, though, because I think about leadership and leadership's impact on culture, on society, because I had a bunch of meetings today with different stages of leaders at my college. So starting with my dean and then moving up to my VP and then all the way up to the president today. And I deeply respect and appreciate the president of the college and the leadership that is here at the institution that I get to work with. I think they genuinely care about the people that they're working for. I think our president views his role as being a steward of the responsibility that he's been given and trying to steward that to the best of his ability. It's the subtle ways that it creeps in. It's the subtle ways that it shifts perspective or behavior, or where do you sit in the room, or what do you expect people to contour their lives to you versus that humility or that service or that intentionality to care for others. The article goes on to say, hierarchy evolved as the most efficient and effective way to organize people. And the reason why hierarchy is such a powerful organizing mechanism for groups is because it solves so many needs the group has. Hierarchy became the most effective way to organize people. Yeah, I'm thinking about when Jesus' disciples were like, yeah, I want to be on your left and your right hand. And then their family comes and says, no, I want them to be on your left and your right. You know, and then his conversations about taking the lowest seat at the table. And even then, Jesus is navigating conversations of hierarchy and authority. And what are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on kingdom perspective on hierarchy and authority in comparison to the way that the world tries to make it happen?
Well, I think hierarchy is a condescension to the flesh and to selfishness. And so it really is who can get the most power gets to control the environment. And I think the kingdom of God is the exact opposite of that. It's a level playing field. There's no hierarchy. And one of the things that people really hated about the shack was we talked about there being no hierarchy in God. Because a lot of Christians see Father, Son under the Father, Holy Spirit under the Son. And so it works because God gets his way and Jesus goes along and the Holy Spirit goes along with Jesus.
Yeah.
When we talk about it, there not being a hierarchy, love and kindness and generosity and justice negates the need for hierarchy. Because you have mutual respect instead, or like Paul talks about for the church, in love, prefer one another. Now, where you have that, you don't need hierarchy. But you can't run a business in honor preferring one another. You can't run a government. And once you put, like we talked about last week, once you put the the life of Jesus into an institution, it's going to become a hierarchy. And the people in charge of it are going to get, if this evidence is true, they're going to get distorted in their thinking that they have the answers and that they're better than the people around them and that they deserve to get more privilege, to get more whatever. He even talks about the amount of abuse that we hear about now from coaches, leaders of organizations, clergymen who abuse women or young boys for their own gain and hide it, and the institutions hide it on their behalf, and all that's becoming exposed in our day. And that's just the privilege of leadership. The privilege of having power over another person is the very thing that God warned us about. But you can't function society without it. So we have hierarchy, and we put it into, quote unquote, the church, like it's in God, so we're going to use it too. And I think that when Jesus says to them about wanting to have first and second place, and he says, "This is, you know, the Gentiles lord it over," it's not so. He really says that's not a reality. That's a faked up mechanism to manage human flesh. And for certain people who have the power, and that's why in marriages, the struggle for power is often the thing that sidetracks the marriage. Who gets to have their way? And there's groups that have taught the male is the head of the home, as Christ is the head of the church. So he gets to have his way about everything, and the woman just shuts up and goes along, and she gets as much influence as the husband is willing to give her. Other than that, she has to compliantly go along. That, what this study shows, and I think scripture shows it as well, that kind of power always corrupts the person who holds it. Unless, here's the one caveat this study offered, if people see power as a responsibility, not a privilege, then they can manage it fairly well. It's a stewardship. It's here to love and to care for people. It's not here for my own amusement, but that's very rare.
Yes, it is.
These guys even talk about when they go present this, they've been invited to Davos, which is someplace in Eastern Europe where all the rich and powerful fly in on their private jets, and they talk about what do we need to know to invest more wisely in the years to come and take more advantage of the people that are under us. And they do presentations along this lines with them, and they think it is a joke. They just laugh at it because they love holding power over people. And they love the money, the influence, the mansions, the jets, the yachts. And it's whether it's celebrities or pastors or whatever strata in our society, it's hard to keep whatever influence God has given you as a responsibility of trust rather than an excuse for indulgence.
What do you think some of the ways, like if you're mirroring this, so we're trying to navigate life here on this earth, right? And we're wanting to live out the kingdom principles. We're wanting to live out the life of Christ in this world, to be a conduit of that, his love in the world. And yet we're also operating in a world that has these hierarchies, these leadership structures, these different elements that are not healthy, that are corruptible, but they also organize, right? They're made in man's knowledge. How do we live in those, in the midst of those, in such a way that is allowing us to be a doorway of kingdom, of life, and yet, like, so does that mean, like, I guess my question is, should we just completely punt any kind of level of influence, authority, leadership, etc.? Should we just punt it because we know that it will corrupt us in the end? Or what do we do with that? How do you protect yourself? How do you keep it a responsibility? What does that look like?
Well, one of the things they say in the article is a high degree of transparency and accountability, that you can't just let the people who have authority run rampant. I remember one kind of teaching that was part of some church I was involved in back in the day was that the senior pastor is a representation of Jesus Christ to the community. I remember one even saying to his elders, look, you're not here to bring the people's concerns to me. You're here to take whatever I tell you to the people and convince them that it's right. So it was just, that was the whole doctrine behind it. Mm. Accountability is really key if you're going to play with hierarchical systems. That's what our founders decided with the three co-equal branches of government who aren't so co-equal anymore because Congress has punted its involvement and no telling what the courts are doing in these days. And we have a very strong executive. We've had that for not just this president, but for a number of presidents. So that kind of accountability, collaboration for CEOs of corporations to take hundreds of millions of dollars and pay their secretary, you know, $20 an hour. That stuff's just crazy. That's part of that indulgence thing. Well, I bring that kind of value. I should get what I need. Without accountability, without honesty, without seeing people you work with on the same level as you, you may have a different responsibility, but they're still, you're just one of them, people. And the fact that you have power doesn't make you right all the time. Like parents who just, I'm the parent, that's why. I'm the parent that makes me right. No, it doesn't make you right. It makes you have more power so you can force your kids, particularly when they're younger, to do what you want them to do. But they will rebel against that as they get older. They will. And you're just loading up a mess for yourself when you're playing the power card. Or I heard from someone this week that talks about their husband has been in this kind of group that the husband has complete authority over everything. And boy, if he's not immediately obeyed, he feels disrespected.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the dynamics we've set up. And one is to be very aware, and particularly if you're a kingdom person, that this kingdom is lateral. Jesus said, you have one father. You are all brothers and sisters. So don't be called leader, teacher, rabbi. Don't fall for the hierarchical games because God doesn't play it and I don't want my people to play it. In the world where there's flesh, you have a business, you're going to have to be the owner. You're going to have to tell people what to do. If you can't keep your heart in a place of realizing it's not about making money, it's about carrying a responsibility to my employees, then you're going to lose it to power. You are. And as you watch other people do it, I know part of the CEO thing is, you know, people, they see that bigger yacht there, the bigger thing there, and the Forbes 100 list of whatever, and it's all a competition to take the most off the table that you can, because what you said earlier about maybe not having a purpose in life, except I've got to get to the top of the heap.
Yeah.
And that makes you a dangerous person.
And it makes you a person who's willing to compromise on, you know, and often, again, that's where the subtlety, that seductive subtlety comes in of, oh, I'll just make this one little adjustment to the way that I'm going to lead or this one little compromise. And it's crazy how fast those build up and how quickly they can all of a sudden become an entirely new way of orienting your life and the way that you treat people and the way that you interact with the world.
Yes. It does. One of the things he says is powerful people are more likely to be self-centered in general. High-powered individuals literally struggle to see the world from other people's perspectives. Mm-hmm. Motor resonance helps us understand each other and empathize with others' experiences and emotions. But guess what? Motor resonance, a fundamental part of what makes us social animals, is lower in high-power individuals. For a lot of scientists who study the effects of power, this is important. Power leads to real biological changes to our brains, our cognition, and our hormones. That's what I think it's really important for us to talk about. Whatever level you hope, husbands in your home, presidents of corporations or owners of businesses or politicians, whatever, if you don't get your hands around how power is going to minimize your personality in terms of kingdom life, and it's going to take you down roads you don't want to go. It did with Saul. It did with David. The whole idea of management over, and even the early church, there, you can't read the New Testament and say there was a pope here or a senior pastor here. You can't. They were mutual. If they had problems, they got together and tried to talk it out. They really lived out this lateral thing, but it wasn't a generation removed from that. That we didn't start already going, well, we got people and money and facility, and so now we need authority and we need doctrine, and we've got to create this hierarchical structure to be the thing that keeps the church pure. And over 2,000 years, it's done a right poor job of that. But once you have an institution around something you call church, the power dynamics will be there.
Yeah.
So wherever in your life you be aware where your power or influence over other people, you've got to be 10 times more careful about not using that power or not letting it distort your perspective, to still care about what the people around you are thinking, to still have empathy for what others around you are facing, and not being able to write that off. Now, part of they say, you know, a high-powered individual, like if your president going to send young men into war, you've got to not care about the number of kids that are going to die because you're sending them to war. And I think, what a horror. No wonder we keep having wars, because we don't care about the kids that are under us. You know, it's just, it's, we're pushing this national agenda that's so important that we've got to, I don't know, overrun Greenland or Canada, or Russia's got to overrun Ukraine, or all the world wars we've started, and local skirmishes are all about not caring about the people you send to war for your greater political or geographical ambitions.
Well, and even who are you going to war with, right? Like, I love the traditions where it's like, if you're in conflict with someone, sit down and have a meal with them. You know, it's hard to be in continual conflict with somebody that you sit down and eat with and have a conversation with, because so often, right, like it's the people that I have found that are most in need of power and authority were also the ones that have some of the highest levels of social fear out there. The fear of not being enough, the fear of being abandoned, and so they try to accrue as much power and influence as they can so they'll never be alone. I mean, whatever the reason behind that is, there's just this deep-seated fear that drives the need, that drives the willingness to be able to compromise on their character and on wholehearted living so that I'm able to establish these ways of getting through life.
So the quest for security.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So whether it's financial security or just significance, I want to be important. Our society plays in that all the time. And I think to be kingdom people, we've got to really make an intentional effort to lean out of that way of thinking, to maintain empathy, to have a heart for justice, for love to dominate our lives, not power. And It is the nature of our flesh to be concerned about power, because the more power I have, the more I get to do what I want.
Yes. And I think that your comment about certainty is a good one, because, or what was the other one you said? Not just certainty.
Security.
Security. Yeah. Because if I'm the one that's calling the shots, then I know how my world is going to be around me. I have the security. I'm the one who's creating it. And yet, it's such an illusion.
Yeah. Or if your institution is growing, or your bank account is a certain point, then you feel like, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm doing better than or most everybody else around me. So I kind of retreat into that place as a space to kind of push the insecurities at bay. Because I have money, I have place, I have influence, I'm important. I do see that conversation a lot inside people's heads, the struggle, because they don't feel like what you said earlier about having purpose. They don't feel like they have purpose and clarity of perspective. So these things become a way to compensate for the lack of that, a place to hide their insecurity, a place to hide their fears, but to try to control as much of their life as they can control, because they're afraid of it getting out of control and then someone else doing it to them. And that's where all human selfish ambition and war and conflict come from. I've got to do it to you before you do it to me.
Yeah. Or do it twice as bad.
I think about that with the lawsuit we got involved in with a book. You know, it was a beautiful thing. We had this wonderful handshake discussion about how we would share the power of it all. And then when it got into a lawsuit and then settled, now we've got to write a contract where I've got to think of every conceivable way you can abuse this. When we first wrote it, it didn't have anything to do with it. None of us anticipated the abuse of another. It was just, we're going to share. As long as we all three made decisions together, we could do whatever we wanted. And then it got to be a contest for power. And now it's, I've got to use a contract to protect me from every, and that contract is the ugliest thing I've ever been a part of in my life. How do I protect myself for every conceivable way you will do me harm because you don't care about me? We just got to remember, God's not a hierarchy. He's not invited us to be part of a hierarchy. He's invited us to love and care and honor, prefer. And where I can live in that community with brothers and sisters, yeah, it's all good. And where I have to form an institution to express that in some way, then it's going to lead to the possibility. And this, I mean, it's just, it's epidemic in our day, how much leaders in our culture end up in sexually abusive situations or monetarily indulgent,
yeah,
ways of living, lifestyles. And he said, that's one of the things I wanted to read earlier. I got lost. Yeah. In 2024, a study published in the Journal Archives of Sexual Behavior found that people with higher perceived power in a relationship are more likely to fantasize about other partners and pursue them. Why? Because feeling powerful increases a person's self-perception as a desirable partner. Someone who is more committed to a relationship is more dependent and may set fewer goals for the couple. It's just, God, the perception that I'm worth this so I can pressure my secretary or a student in my classroom or, oh my gosh. I got an email this week from a woman that kind of outlined for me. She's, I think, in her 40s now, but she outlined all the ways as a young, as a teenager through college years, how much coaches, teachers tried to put her in compromising situations because she was a woman. And it was a lot. I was reading this going, why do we put up with this? And so any relationship in which we have power over another, it can just be a person from my classroom. It can be an individual in my congregation. If I have power over, which is why Jesus encourages not to do that, anyone who says that, and the podcast you referred to last week, the Royce Report about cover, the whole doctrine of covering is putting someone over us because we've got to be under them, and it's completely non-scriptural. It's anti-scriptural. It's anti-Christ, the whole idea of power over. And yet that's a doctrine that most people, I still get the emails from a lot of people going, well, what do I do for covering now that I don't go to a congregation? Yeah.
It's such a conversation both in and how that got so deeply ingrained and socially accepted in evangelical Christianity. I don't understand it because it's not just, it's talking about leadership of the church and the people who attend the church, talking about marriages, as we talked about before. I mean, it's just like, I mean, I can't tell you how many conversations I've been in with women from conservative Christian backgrounds and the abuse that was occurring, or the, whether it be physical, sexual, psychological, emotional, because they were under the covering of this person and they didn't want to come out from underneath it. Or even parenting, like you kids, you're under my covering and I'm going to do X, Y, and Z to bring you into alignment and get you to where you need to be. And if you leave, if you go out away from me, then all hell's going to break loose on you because you're out from underneath my covering or their covering.
Yeah. It's not so much you don't want to, deathly afraid to. Their salvation hinges on being under someone else's covering and their own ability to think about having discernment about between what's good and false, true and not true, is being compromised by this hideous doctrine from hell that has put people under. And that's it's a great teaching if you're a power person. If you want to be at the top of the heap and control people, covering is a great doctrine to go to. It's just not the character of Christ. And so when anybody starts talking covering, run like crazy. What I loved about this whole thing was wherever you end up picking up power or influence, you got to be super careful. Are you going to end up in a place of darkness that you can't even see anymore? And that's the scariest kind of trap when you don't see it and you think God has blessed you by the power covering you provide for people when you're actually destroying yourself and them.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.